Hi, everyone. Welcome to Faith in the Folds, a podcast for Ministry of Biblical Studies and Christian Living. I'm your host, Kevin Berg. Joining me for the second time on the podcast is Smith Hopkins, a church planter in Memphis, Tennessee, with 20 years of ministry experience. Smith and the team at Oikos Church are celebrating their second anniversary in the University District of East Memphis, and it's a joy to have you back on the podcast, Smith. Thank you for joining us today.
Kevin, I'm so grateful to be here. I cannot believe it has already been 3 years since I was on your podcast, but it's an honor to be back.
So we were talking about that right before we started recording, and I was saying, oh, like, we're going to do this for like the 1 year anniversary, right? And then you said two, no, three. It's like, there's no way. But you went back and checked. It was 3 years ago that I interviewed you as you were about to start working at Oikos, right?
Yeah, at that point, we were describing our place as a church as like a baby in gestation, that it had a heartbeat, but it wasn't even viable yet. Mm-hmm. And it's we're a toddler now. We're living and breathing and walking. Hopefully a long life ahead of us, but amen, just getting started. But yeah, time flies, man.
Yeah, time is moving three times as fast. You know, the gray hairs in our beards, we're not there. When we first ran into each other in Memphis many years ago.
For better or worse, that is totally true.
Yeah.
And when you introduce me as having 20 years of experience, if anybody's on video, they're like, there's no way that guy is many years older than 20. But
right. Well, the beard hides it. Otherwise, mm-hmm, there would be this, you know, pouty baby face. No, I'm
kidding. That's right. Can't deny it.
Well, Smith, it's a treat to have you on the podcast again, mm-hmm, and it was so much fun getting to catch up with you last month at the Harding School of Theology reunion, mm-hmm, when Dr. Chris Wright, eminent Old Testament professor, was able to join the school for the Doctor of Ministry weekend. So good to catch up with old friends, mm-hmm, and to you know, to make new friends and get to meet some of my students in person. It was just it was a treat to be there. Do you have any, I didn't prepare you for this, but do you have any like real positive takeaways from that weekend that you have been reflecting on since then?
I mean, the weekend, the word of the weekend was bittersweet. I don't know how many times you heard that word, but I live across the street from the school. I walk there. That school, the campus, is such a special place. The people are so meaningful and important in my story. It was really wonderful to be able to see many of them again, to meet even new ones on really kind of a farewell event over there. Chris Wright is awesome. Loved Chris Buxton's lecture on campus ministry. That's kind of a near to my heart and what we're trying to do at Oikos Church here in Memphis, with the University of Memphis. It was a really special time. It was bittersweet, though, as we think of, you know, ends and new beginnings and some of that. I was glad to run into you, though.
Yeah, likewise. Mm-hmm. I was, I too really reflected highly on Chris Buxton's discussion on campus ministry. Mm-hmm. And I've had the good fortune of having Chris and a couple of other campus ministers on the podcast. That was also probably about 3 years ago, because that was one of the first interviews I had where I had multiple people on. Mm. Also worthwhile, and not just for the obvious reasons, for those of you who know me and my interest in New Testament, I really enjoyed Garrett Best's discussion. Mm-hmm. But what I appreciated so much about Garrett was, I mean, Garrett is growing and budding into becoming, you know, a recognized authority on the Book of Revelation, mm-hmm, even at the ripe old age of 36, you know, 36 or something like that. Mm-hmm. He's got his hand in a lot of cool things with the Society of Biblical Literature and, mm-hmm, Christian Scholars Conference, and doing all kinds of great stuff like that. But what Garrett also brings to those discussions is a pastoral bent that comes from his years in congregational ministry, something that you and I both have as well. You know, we kind of find ourselves in these dual worlds of, you know, being able to, you know, discuss things at a serious technical level, but also knowing the importance of, you know, being there to comfort those who mourn. and to rejoice with those who rejoice. And so Garrett's discussion of a description rather of Gen Z and how his students, many of whom at York University, many of whom are might have some church background or have no church background whatsoever. They have such what we would consider bizarre views on a number of important topics, but they're willing to give Jesus a try. I think that was his words. Like, you know, if you show them what Jesus has to offer, willing to give them a try. And that was really important for me because I've got a heart for, you know, for reaching our younger folks at church. And, you know, in my role as a student, the older I get, my students in the past at Harding School of Theology are generally in their 20s or so. You know, I'll have occasionally a student who's older than me, but reaching them in you know, in equipping them to be able to do better what God has called them to do, that's all very meaningful too. So yeah, yes, bittersweet is the right word for it.
Could I comment just a little on Garrett?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Love that guy. His lecture on the state of New Testament studies, kind of looking into the future, was so good. And he was actively trying to translate it for, you know, just regular church people.
Yeah.
It was both sides of Garrett at the same time. The scholar who was up to date with all the latest trends and what's happening at SBL.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also then trying to give a pastoral heart for Gen Z and translate even the jargon of SBL to the language
Oh, yeah.
of the people in the pew who weren't really quite tracking with some of even what SBL might be talking about.
Yeah,
So
right, yeah. Yeah.
He's impressive. He hustles. He gets after it. Love that guy.
Yeah.
Special friend of mine. Yep.
So for those of you who are listening to the podcast, thank you. And if you also happen to know Garrett best, you don't have to go out of your way to tell him that we are being so kind to him. You know, we don't want Garrett to get a big head.
Just
you
rub
know,
his
we...
head next time you see him.
I have had Garrett on in the past to talk with him and Alan Howell about some work that they did on, you know, kind of contextualizing the Book of Revelation in, you know, particularly in Alan's work in Mozambique.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. So, you know, good to make all these connections, and especially worthwhile for anyone who happens to be in, you know, some kind of school context,
yep.
And also, you know, in a ministry context as
mm-hmm.
well. One of the things that you know, our calling involves is being able to take really the best of what's relevant from, you know, academic, you know, rigorous study of the Bible, and like you said, to translate that. There is, those are different, I think you could call them subcultures.
Mm-hmm.
And Smith, I imagine that you have had to put some of that into practice with what you've done in your work as a church planter, maybe not just taking your academic study of the Bible during your MDiv days at HSC, but also your ministry context in more established traditional churches of Christ, traditional in the sense that, you know, longstanding institutions, you know, not what would not be considered church plants anymore. Though, you know, those two contexts have inevitably or undeniably shaped you for church planning. But help us kind of walk through there. Like, how did you get into church planning, and how have you, like, what all have y'all, you know, talk to us a little bit about sort of how things are going these first
mm-hmm.
2.5 or so years in Oikos Church.
Yeah, well, let me start with just kind of how I got into it.
Yeah.
I talked about this last time. It's been 3 years.
Apparently.
Let's see if I even remember.
I don't know.
I grew up in a small town in Texas. Later in my high school years, felt called into ministry with the help of my local preacher and his discernment. He
Can
kind of
I
nudged
ask,
me into it.
what did that look like? Because I didn't expect to be doing what I'm doing. And yet here I am. And so I'm always curious what that looks like, because I want to be able to spot that in others.
Yes. I wouldn't have used the language of call at that point in my life. But what it looked like is my senior year of high school, my church was hosting like a Bible Bowl competition, sort of like Last Leaders, but more local.
Yeah.
more scrappy.
More scrappy,
And
is that what you said?
yeah, absolutely. And so for the first time, they were having, in addition to the Bible Bowl stuff, a sermon outline contest. Not a
Wow.
preaching contest, a sermon outline contest. And my preacher came to me. He said, "We're the host church, and we don't have any entries. You're a senior in this group. Can if you do it, some others might also do it." And so I was like, "Sure, I'll write an outline." And it was the first sermon outline I had ever written. I thought of myself as a leader in our youth group. I was active, but I wanted to be a basketball coach, and that was what I thought I was good at, and that's kind of the direction I saw for my life. And I did that sermon outline contest. A few other guys in the church did as well, so it paid off in that regard. And then I presented it to a small panel of preachers, and one of which was my local preacher. And actually, his name is Kevin. And at the bottom of my evaluation sheet, he said something like, "You should seriously consider becoming a preacher." And I was like, I have never thought about becoming a preacher ever. That's not what my dad did. You know, I don't, if anything, my family ancestry has an aversion to ministry.
No.
I had family trips across the country to try to talk me out of being a Bible major. Not from my parents, but from others in my family. They were just concerned about like the financial implications and how the church would treat you.
Yeah.
And
And those
you
concerns are not
know,
unfounded.
that's totally
Like
right.
you and I both know,
They
like
have
that's,
all come true. Yes.
yeah, like that's not totally unfounded.
That's
But
right.
it's pretty wild that they took it that seriously to drive across
Yeah. Yeah.
country to
You
ask
know, they
him.
had some family that had been burned in similar situations and
Yeah.
didn't want to see the same for me. They thought I was capable of having financial security and possibly even wealth if I wanted to. And that evaluation, that one line, and then the kind of the affirmation of the community, the punishment for winning the sermon outline contest was that you had to preach it in front of the conference. And so I just
Like
showed
I
up there
said,
and read it as fast as
punishment.
I could. And I was terrified. And then my community overwhelmingly confirmed what clearly was not like a gift of preaching. I don't know what exactly they were affirming, but they were incredibly affirming of me. And so that started me considering some more things, you know, getting a few more open doors and opportunities in the youth group and at my local church. And pretty soon, I just discerned that I'm going to Freed. Why don't I swap my major from like sports exercise science over to Bible? And why don't I pursue this? I would say that was confirmed even more when I got to Freed Hardeman. And my first week on campus, the one guy I knew in town called me and said, "Hey, our preacher didn't come back to school. Could you fill in this Sunday?" And I was like, "Sure. I have this one sermon outline that I wrote for this competition." And I preached that. They said, "Well, you preach from the Old Testament. This is not a church that has ever listened to sermons from the Old Testament." I was like, "Well, that's a problem. That's all I got." And on Monday, he called me back and said, "They loved it. Will you continue to be our preacher?" And so for the next 4 years at Freed Hardeman, 18 years old, I started preaching. That's how you get 20 years of ministry
Yeah.
experience. Is you say yes to weird open doors before you have the maturity to even know that you shouldn't be there. So.
So often that this, and I found this to be true in my experience. I imagine it's true in yours as well. So often God is preparing us for something
That's right.
before we even know we're going to need it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I can't help but chuckle at this, Smith. You said the guy came up to you and said that their preacher didn't come back to school. So was the
That's right.
other preacher a student as well?
I think he was a grad school student.
Wow.
There were six people at this church. You know,
Okay.
it was when I got there were six people.
Yeah.
Phenomenal growth. By the time I left, we had almost 30.
Wow. Praise God. That's great.
500%. What can
Yeah,
you do?
man. You didn't go to the board of Oikos Church with those numbers, right? Like in
That's
4 years,
probably
I
not their
can
goal.
guarantee 500% growth.
If only.
Oh,
Well, can I continue with the story? I've stayed too
yeah.
long. I'm sorry. So from Free to Hardeman, I went to HST in Memphis. That's where we met. And I ministered at a local church in town. And then our Garrett Best, our mutual friend that we were just talking about, he actively recruited me to a preaching role at the church that he was at in town. So when he went off to get his PhD with you, I stepped in for him and I served there for several years. And just what you're saying, it's like every step along the way, the Lord was preparing me in some way. And I didn't really know that until my church planting assessment. Assessment is my wife and I went to DC and we had all these assessors. There were, I don't know, 15 to 20 people
So
who
this
would
was like
just
a
ask.
conference or something you went to?
Conference makes it sound too big.
Okay.
This is a pretty typical thing in the church planting world
Okay.
where someone who's interested in church planting needs to get vetted at a really deep level
Yeah.
before
Oh,
an
yeah.
institution or a church will invest financially in them. And so they'll put them through the ringer and they'll ask all kinds of hard questions from your financials to your sex life to your doctrinal views to all of your ministry experiences. And they're actually working from kind of like a data set, these 16 categories of these things. If you score well in these things, then you're more apt to be able to lead a strong church plant. And it, as it turned out, kind of as we look back on our life and we just told stories about what the Lord had been doing in our life and what we were able to do, what they shared is that in your experience, you've been precisely prepared for this type of role. And so church planting was always a passion project. It was kind of a side hobby. The late, great Tim Keller was probably at a national scale, the voice that would talk. I mean, he planted a church in New York City and he was writing books as soon as I got out of college. And then within our network, it was a guy named David Young who kind of introduced me to the concept of church planting. David Young's at North Boulevard in the Middle Tennessee area. And so that passion project turned into just a very much a burden on our heart. As I think I shared last time, I started trying to lead Shelby County churches and I was asking, if not us, then who? You know, there's not a denominational board that's going to take care of this. There's not a North
Right.
American Mission Board as there is in Southern Baptist churches. If this is going to happen, it's got to happen because local leaders and local churches are thinking bigger than their own context. And that's just a really hard hurdle to get over for most local churches. And so at some point, the question shifted from, if not us, church leaders, then who? To me and my wife, if not us, then who? In a much more personal way. And after the assessment, they kind of confirmed the call and we stepped away from established church ministry into the great unknown of what it would look like to plant a church. We got a lot of training, a lot of help along the way, some really great guides for the journey. And in January of 2022, we officially launched Oikos Church in Memphis with just enormous help from lots of people and lots of churches, especially our sending church, which is Highland Church Christ in the Memphis, Tennessee area.
Okay, yeah.
So just an amazing experience. So some of how it's gone since we've launched, actually since we talked, I mean, we didn't even have a launch team. Like it was really just me and my wife
Yeah.
and an idea. There's this song that I think about all the time. I call it my church planting song. I never had a dime, but I always had a vision. So that was me last time we talked on your podcast. And what the Lord did is that he helped us clarify a team of 12 that started meeting in our home. And then later that year, the team of 12, we started hosting kind of community engagement activities. We'd host big meals, we'd host worship events, we'd meet at a park. This is like COVID era, so
Yeah, right.
public events were still a little odd. And then most of all, our sending church Highland kind of welcomed us in and said, we'd love for you to preach about church planting. If anybody wants to help and go with you, you have our blessing. And so between Highland and some other community engagement things that we were doing, those 12 built what we call the launch team of, I don't know, between 60 and 70. And January 2022, we launched. The Lord gave us a really wonderful space, and we prayed for 200 people on our launch Sunday to show up, and we had 201 people on our launch Sunday to grow up to show up. And we have consistently seen that where it's like, he has answered precisely what our prayers are. And I know he can do far abundantly above all that we ask or imagine.
Yeah.
But so far in our prayers, he's often just given us very, very much what we've asked
Yeah.
for.
201. Just to make sure, right? That
Yes.
if somebody miscounted,
Abundantly above, man. So
you've got just a little bit more.
and we knew a lot of those were well-wishers and family members and people like
Sure.
that. So
Yeah.
in church planting, you kind of say, well, if that's where you start, within a few weeks it's going to be down to half. And that's what we wanted 200 for, because if you can have 100 people, now you have a sustainable church. Like there's a sizable enough group that you're probably going to make it. And in a lot of church planting, if you're just trying to see, are you going to be around in 7 years? Are you going to be around in 10 years? A lot of it, you just look at where you launch. And if you can launch with 100 people, you're probably going to make it, barring something else that happens.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and in the last couple of years, there's kind of been a lot of twists and turns as the Lord would have it, but we're still here, toddling around as a 2-year-old church.
About what's, however y'all define attendance, what about what are y'all at these days?
We probably have about 130.
Okay.
We can push into the 150s. Our partnership is actually above that, you know, the number of adults who kind of associate with us and their kids.
Yeah.
But given the age of our church, we have a lower attendance than the kind of makeup of our church. And that's pretty typical for most churches, but I think that affects us a lot.
Yeah.
That the makeup of our church, I say it's about a third. Let's call it 150. But there's about 50 kids, 12 and under. And then there's about 50 people in their 20s. And then there's about 50 people 30 and over. So if you show up and you're 30 years old, there's a guy in our church named Thomas. And I just call him Old Tom now because he's 32 and he's helping lead a group. So it's
Old Tom.
Old Tom, 32.
At 32, man.
Yep.
Mark of distinction and maturity, 32 years old.
We prayed for a really unique incorporation of kids into the life of our church. And we prayed for college and young adults to come to our church. And just what I was just saying, the Lord answered those prayers very specifically. So we have started praying for maturity and elders, you know, some older people
Oh
to show up. So
yeah.
the Lord has been slower to answer the prayer of wise, mature people who can help carry this load, and he has given far more of the young people.
All right.
Keep praying.
Yeah. How have you found it? How have you found doing things intergenerationally? You know, is it difficult? Are the younger third The younger two-thirds, so the 20s
Yes.
down, are they ex you know interested in spending time and doing activities and things together with the older third? Does the older third feel exasperated by the younger two-thirds? Like, what are some of those dynamics like?
Yeah, it's all of that.
So all the above.
I can flesh that out though. There is a really beautiful, unique part of our church culture that kids are just, they're in it. I mean, they're vocal, they participate. If you showed up to one of our Sunday gatherings, there's probably going to be just children kind of wandering around and vocal. They're going to be participating. They're going to be participating at our table time when we share the bread and the cup. They're going to be verbally participating. We give a prompt to share, and the kids all share too. They're probably going to be leading doxology. So even in our Sunday gathering, they're incorporated. But really, the heart of our church isn't Sunday. It's our group life, and our kids are very much integrated into our group life. That they know. I mean, we meet with these people all the time. they're always in our home. Their best friends are in our group. It's a beautiful picture of a multi-generational family that was prayed for. And I've been reading those researchers, at Fuller Institute, and some of what they're doing with how to integrate young adults and college students and children into the life of faith. And that's what creates sticky faith. Kara Powell and her work, this is what makes faith sustainable on into adulthood. And so it was like, what would that look like if it were just embedded into a church from the very beginning? And I get the privilege of raising my kids in that environment. So it's really, really beautiful. And yet it's also really hard because two-thirds of our church are under 30 years old. And so if you have any maturity, you're probably being asked to do a whole lot of things. You're probably mentoring someone who's 23 years old. You're also trying to raise your own kids. You're probably being asked to lead a ministry or at least serve in one. So it puts a lot of pressures on the mature who are carrying the load. And of course, anytime if you get two or three big families, if you have four or five kids, and we have a few families with four or five kids, at some point you just have so many kids running around. It's hard to do, anything that's intellectually stimulating or emotionally vulnerable in those environments. And so we have to be really intentional with a lot of how we do group life and church life because of the makeup of our church. I totally find that people in their 20s want mentors. They mean something different by mentor than what I might mean. Generally, they mean somebody to listen to them and buy them coffee.
Because well, and because it doesn't stop just there though, right? Like it's not just what they see as someone to spend time with them. It's more than that, even if they can't necessarily verbalize that. Is that a fair assessment, would you say?
It depends on the young person.
Sure,
I think
that's fair.
everyone needs someone to l listen to them, and young people in particular, especially in our screen age, have very few in-person experiences where someone is listening to them deeply. And so, if you can have an older person who will listen to you deeply, they will prioritize you and time with you. But some of what I think of as mentoring is more life on life. And we're still trying to kind of grow some of our people in their 20s into this. It's like, it would be a beautiful thing for you to be with my family and to see our bedtime routines and to be a part of dinner. We're open to all of that. We do some of that. But if you're going to be able to do that, you're going to have to also like come alongside in a more mutual way. I've got yard work to do. Why don't you come help me with that? And we can talk as we're doing. So there is still a sense with many young people of just needing to receive, 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 receive. And that can be extremely draining on leaders. So how do we do both? That's some of what we're trying to figure out.
How have you been able to get some of these younger people in their 20s to do more giving? And I don't mean financially, but in the context of receive, receive, receive. Have you been able to find ways for getting them to give more in terms of being what they have received?
Yes. And like I said, we're still growing in all of that. One of the key ways is just we have a really robust sense of service and ministry in our church. We're church plant. If you're showing up here, we have a job for you. It's not like we have generations of people who are passing this on. We need everything. And so over 90% of our partners or members are active in serving on a monthly team. 90%. Normally it's like 10% are doing 90% of the work.
I've heard that before. When I worked up in Nicholasville, somebody was sharing some of this. I think we had an Everett Hufford come up and do kind of like a church assessment with us, which was really informative. And I don't remember if it was him or somebody else, but the comment was made, you know, in a lot of churches, it's 20% of the people do 80% of the work, vice versa. And I heard the rebuttal to that was, it's like, well, if 20% of people are working, then only 20% of the work is being done. And that really struck me. It's like, oh, wow. Like, imagine if 100% of the church is working at 100% capacity. Okay, give or take. It's like, what extraordinary benefit to the kingdom does that look like then? But I know what you mean. That's Smith, that's pretty extraordinary. Is it something that's just inherent to a church plant, or is it something that y'all have actively cultivated? And if so, how have y'all done that?
Yeah, I think it's probably a mixture of both.
Okay.
Church plants attract people who aren't just there to receive and be consumers. If you want a consumer experience, we are not the church for you.
Yeah.
There are churches for you, and I don't even say that as a criticism. Given life stage and kind of faith stage, sometimes you may need to be at a place where you can just sit and rest for a while. We're not that for many people. We're going to ask you to actively practice discipleship to Jesus. We're going to ask you to actively serve on a ministry team, and we're going to ask you to actively participate in a group, in a community environment. And that's a pretty high threshold. And that's where like the intentionality, the cultivation of that comes in. That's the type of church we want to be. There are other types of churches, even on our street, you know, that are like, we'll put it all on for you if you'll just show up. That's not us. We're not a performance oriented church. We're more of a participation oriented church. And it's not for everybody, but you kind of know that when you show up to a church plant. And that's actually what I think is, I don't know, it's that's the church that I see in the New Testament at least. When I read Acts, I see a church that's engaged in one another's lives, living in community, actively practicing discipleship.
Oh, yeah.
That seems to me to be Christianity. And so I think we need fuller expressions of Christianity in the secular age that we find ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's just going to be, it is countercultural, though. Most people didn't grow up in that kind of church.
Right. That kind of work is something that I would say gives meaning. I mean, that's just from secular conversations and podcasts that I hear over the years, take a guy like Mike Rowe, okay? Mike Rowe. I don't know his church background. He, for a public celebrity, seems like a decent guy. I think that's fair. Had this great show, Dirty Jobs, it's a dirty job, somebody's got to do it, and has really been promoting the value of work. And occasionally when he gets philosophical, he and some of the people that he's hosted or that have hosted him on their podcast, he will comment on, there is a sense of meaning and purpose that comes from finding work that adds value in a positive way. Now, we would look at that and say something that glorifies God and therefore, generates the human flourishing that God always intended for creation to experience, for humans. In the humans as the image of God to experience. And he doesn't necessarily use that language. He might be there, but generally that's how you and I would see that. And yeah, that makes perfect sense that the church ought to be the place, right, where you can come, we together can discern your gifts and help you grow in those. But in positions of leadership like what you and I have, we are spiritually obligated to help those, the people who come. We're obligated to give them, the opportunities and the venues for being able to use those gifts. That's one thing that I've been really convicted about in my church, in my church context. And thankfully, we are continuing to grow in that. Smith, it seems like something that y'all were aware of that day one and have continued to kind of chip away at
Yeah.
that.
Man, that resonates a lot. The meaning of even meaningful work, you know, micro stuff, but the meaning of relationships and community. I think, especially in a post-COVID world, that it pulled back and revealed a hunger for loving community that maybe we didn't realize was fully there yet. But some of the greatest meaning that we have seen in the new people who come into Oikos is not in ministry, it's not even in community, it's in just basic discipleship. And so we have a discipleship course that we force everyone. They think it's like the new member class, like the 101 class. And it's actually like a discipleship boot camp. It's an 8-week group course where you're going through it with new people, where you're building your own personal rhythm of life. And consistently, people describe those 2 months as a life-changing experience where for the first time they were taught how to practice their faith. And in many cases, these people at one point were active in church and they kind of grew up in church in a family of faith. We're in Memphis. It's one of the most church cities in the country.
Oh
And
yeah.
so
Oh,
everybody has a home church.
the Bible Belt. I mean
Yes.
that it you know runs Bible Belt basically runs like through I-40, you know.
Sure. Yeah. I wish that was on the signs, like the Bible Belt Memorial Highway.
It really is. You
Yes.
know, and it hits 65, you know, as it cuts through Tennessee and Alabama, right?
That's the
But
zipper of the Bible Belt.
you know, the Bible Belt is kind of a weirdly shaped belt, but it's absolutely a real thing though. Corpus
It
is
is.
not in the Bible Belt, but because of the Mexican cultural heritage,
Yes.
church is still very important.
Yes.
It looks different than what it might look like in Memphis, but I don't know, maybe not. Anyway.
So if everybody has a home church, but no one has ever practiced their faith,
Yeah.
when you come to a church that says, here are some ways to actively follow Jesus in your day-to-day life and in community with us, and they think, I have never done this before. This is amazing. And Kevin, we're talking about pretty basic stuff, like give thanks every day, reflect on the word, have spiritual conversations. There's a rhythm of life that we share with everybody that's just kind of the basics of what discipleship would look like at any church, for the first 300 years of our people. And it's a brand new thing. No one has ever walked them through it. And in many cases, they think, well, this is something for like preachers and ministers. And then they say things like, I didn't realize that I could do this too.
Yeah.
And so there is a meaning, but the meaning is it's just in actively practicing the Christian faith. What a revolutionary idea.
Yeah. It reminds me of the consistent description of God's people as a priesthood of believers who are a priestly nation. Yeah.
Hey, 1 Peter 2, Oikos is all over that chapter.
Amen.
So,
And
yeah.
as well you should be, because it's a beautiful chapter and draws extensively from Old Testament imagery. So again, God has always wanted this group of people who are characterized by a holiness that is not defined by the ways that holiness came to be defined in Jesus' time, which were more negatively based, but a holiness that, enabled God's presence, or a holiness that enabled the people to receive and experience God's life-giving, peace-making and beautiful presence. I'm working through, you mentioned Chris Wright earlier. I happen to have right here the book that I'm working on for my Wednesday night class, Knowing the Holy Spirit Through the Old Testament by Chris Wright. Really enjoying this. Smith, go grab it. You'll like it. He's got a trio of books, one might say a trinity of books, on knowing God, knowing the Father through the Old
Yes,
Testament, knowing
yes.
Jesus through the Old Testament, knowing the Holy Spirit through the Old Testament. I'm doing the Holy Spirit right now.
Love that.
And so, like, all that's just kind of rolling around up here. But it sounds, sounds like that's the kind of thing that y'all are shooting for.
Yeah, I mean, 1 Peter 2, he even uses the word oikos. He's making you into a spiritual house, a
Yeah,
spiritual
yeah, yeah.
oikos. He says you are strangers in the world. Strangers is the word par oikos. It's like you're not in that house,
Yeah.
you're God's house. You're a counterculture of people that God is forming into a priesthood, into a special spirit-filled house, a family, a home. So yeah, that's very much what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And also similar imagery found in Ephesians 2 as well, building
That's
you
right.
up as a spiritual temple. The idea, right, of a spiritual building in a culture that was very particular about protecting the physical building where God's presence was. Just so many good things there. Smith, why? I mentioned that y'all are in the University District of East Memphis, so like right near the University of Memphis. It sounds like, though, you're moving in the wrong direction. You're moving towards the city instead of away from the city. Cities are bad and yucky and gross. Why?
You're not wrong.
I can say that because I went to high school in downtown Nashville and like had to park and walk, like 2 blocks to get to high school, like right on Broadway. So for those of you who know Nashville, if you know that my high school is right on Broadway, then you'll know where I went to high school. But like I'm around, I've been around cities and they're gross and there's crime and stuff like that. Why did y'all go there?
There are actually some days that I'm like, why did we go here?
Or did I just happen to list the reasons why you went there, right? With crime and all this other stuff.
It's actually even more specific than city. It's really like an Acts 19 educational institutions within the city. The university context in the United States, I think, is a very unique, fertile mission field. That because they're located in cities, many of those churches are leaving. As people leave the cities, as churches leave the cities, they're migrating to where their people are, and they're migrating where there's more and cheaper land that's available, lower taxes, better schools, all the reasons that people might leave a city. But part of what they're leaving behind are the young people moving into the heart of those cities who may not really want a church. And certainly can't financially sustain a church. Or their faith can't sustain a church. And so it seems like there's sometimes we talk about the brain drain that happens in a lot of rural contexts where certain cities like Austin in your area are attracting some of the most talented people around the country. In my context, there's so many similar effects happening in the city of Memphis. But my burden to church planting was there, but my burden to church planting was always flavored with the transition that's happening in the lives of young adults between 18 and 25 years old. And the reason is because there's two big baton passes that aren't being made. So when someone graduates from a youth group, they are the most religiously active group in the United States. Like
Youth groups.
a youth group age kind of person of faith is the most active. And then as soon as they start college, they join a cohort of the least religiously active people. So
Wow.
they go from the most to the least in months. And it's because there's a baton pass, right? You normally leave home or you leave family or you leave some of the kind of webbing that was making church attendance a part of it.
Without calling it a rite of passage, I think still within an American context, it is a rite of passage. Now, and granted, like things have changed, right? Like you and I didn't work our way through college. We might have worked in college, but we weren't working a side job to pay for college. We had scholarships and parents and loans and stuff like that. So okay, like it's a little different, but it's still a rite of passage and successful completion of that. Depending on how one defines success, but the ways that I'm thinking of, successful completion of that means that in a sense, you have taken one greater step towards adulthood. I think it's fair. So, and that, that's.
It's for many young people, it starts a process of differentiation from their parents and from their religious upbringing. But the crazy thing is that those same 18 to 25 year olds who are stepping away from church are incredibly open to faith decisions and formation. It in many ways is probably the most formative experience from 18 to 25 at any point in their lives in terms of worldview and values and what they think is important. And so I actually think we need more churches with an eye towards not only Gen Z, but particularly in university and college contexts because of what's happening. And we were praying to be within a mile of the University of Memphis, and the Lord answered that prayer too. We are 1 mile away from the University of Memphis. Yet again, it's just like a very precise answer to prayer. But, actually, it seems that the Lord is closing that door. This is some news for our community that I can
Okay,
share
yeah.
soon. And so we're just kind of re-engaging the Lord again so that he could open up a new door where he wants us. And I don't know where that will be this time. We have been established on the campus. We're now a registered student organization. It took us a little while to get the right number of students and email addresses and things like that. But it feels like we have something of a foothold. And maybe we can expand our radius to some other things. But this, the life of a church planner, though, is there's just all of these insecurities that you sort of take for granted, that I would take for granted as I worked at an established church in the suburbs. It's just, there are things that you can just count on. They're going to be there. You got the building, you got kind of the older people who are going to be there and who are going to give. And church planning just has a variety of different challenges that come with the territory, location being one. But wherever we go, we're going to prioritize the faith formation of college and young adults. And that's why a lot of our people over 30 are there, because they love Gen Z. We talk about Gen Z all the time. If you're a college or young adult person at Oikos, our church loves you, that we are here for you, and that we want to be a part of your life, and we want to see the name and the faith of Jesus Christ kind of flourish in your 20s. So that's very much part of the culture of our excuse me, of our community. Sorry about that. Of our community at Oikos. In fact, our last two baptisms, quick story. So
Yeah, no,
launch
we've got
Sunday.
time for it. Go for it.
Yeah, I talked about launch Sunday a little bit ago, January of 2022. And we did a little bit of advertising on Facebook and things like that. And somebody came in the door for the first time. We never met her. She was a college student from the University of Memphis who had seen some of our ads on Instagram. And she showed up. She decided to look for a church. She was our first baptism
Wow.
at Oikos Church.
Praise God.
And our last two baptisms include her twin brother and her brother's friend. So it's been a beautiful thing to see what the Lord can do through a lot of prayer around certain topics that he has burdened our hearts with. And he's bearing fruit in some ways. And yet, even as I say that, we're very much entering what feels like a time of pruning where he's going to cut back so that he can make more fruit in the future. In the sense of John 15, that he takes the trees and the branches that bear good fruit, and then he removes good things to make room for greater things. And that's very much what we're discerning that the Lord might be doing in this current season. We're excited to see the new fruit, but man, the pruning process, where we're again looking for a place and kind of navigating challenges, it can be really taxing.
Yeah, I bet. Smith, as you as we've been reflecting on your time there with Oikos, prior to going into this work, you had some notions about what it would be like. What are maybe some of those notions that God dispelled that those not watching, Smith is chuckling. What were some things that maybe God said, well, this isn't exactly like how it's going to be? And how'd y'all navigate some of that?
There's so many of those stories. Some of it is like worship style and model. It looks nothing like the kind of ministry that I was accustomed to, that I was comfortable with, and I was
Sure.
relatively good at. I don't know. And so it's so much stretching, new experimentation. And that's a weird place to be in. at this point in my ministry, you know, after 20 years, I wouldn't expect to be doing so much experimentation on, hey, what if we tried this for the first time ever? How do I lead our people into something that I've never done and I don't feel like I'm, why would they follow me there?
Reminds
There's
me
just
of a certain
personally a
someone
whole
from
lot of that.
scripture.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I spoke over you. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm trying to think of some specific stories where I feel that. You know, the first year, I would describe it to my church planting buddies as like a honeymoon.
Sure.
It's so good. Just trust and joy, and we doubled in size in 1 year, and it incredible. And yet, even as it was all happening, I said, "This is a honeymoon. This is a honeymoon." And the thing about honeymoons is that at some point they end, and sometimes you kind of know when they end. Man, what we found is that that first group of 12 that met in my home, and we had this beautiful connection that was love and trust and shared mission, and we wanted to do this together. And then as the church doubled in size, all of us were now leading our own groups. All of us had weight of ministry and group leadership, and we could barely even get in the same room together because everyone is just hosting in their own homes. And so rather than having the weekly experience of just sitting in my living room, kind of seeking the Lord together and worshiping and praying and sharing a meal, now we miss them. So that year two, kind of that just became so clear to all of us. And the way it showed up was in pain points. Like, we missed each other and we were frustrated that we couldn't be together. And so we had to do some leadership restructuring to try to make room for kind of being together, having the right people making decisions that they could move faster, even as we had all these other responsibilities. I think a big discovery was what we now call rhythm of life. We had to introduce a new core value into our church. It was something that was implicitly there before, but had to become explicit to guard people who loved the community and they loved the Lord and the church, and they would just pour themselves into it to the point of exhaustion and near burnout. So sabbaticals became kind of a regular part of what a lot of our people were doing. We had to start guarding how many things you could participate in. So there was a lot of what felt like really good things. But then as they went on and stretched out, we realized that they were really tiring things. And I think that's probably the clearest way that the Lord has kind of gotten our attention. And it's like, you need to, you know, I'm a very mission-driven person. I have deeply held values and convictions, and I want to go on behalf of the Lord and for his glory and for his name. I want to go see those brought to bear in the world. And yet, you can only do it within your limits. So, I mean, even now, just this past month, we've introduced the practice of Sabbath to all of our partners in our groups to try to get them to experiment on their own with better rhythms and balance. So, what would it look like to practice a rhythm of life rather than just overwork? And we certainly don't have that figured out. There's still lots of fits and starts and frustrations, but the Lord's been teaching us a lot of things there.
Smith, as we start to wrap up our time together this afternoon, talk to me about, kind of what you hope Oikos looks like in 3 years and 5 years,
I am part of my process in leading is to continually kind of put that before our leadership team and our church. And yet, like today, I'm really hesitant. I'm not even sure what we're going to look like in 3 to 5 months. I mean, genuinely.
because of the venue change.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the place we launched in was perfectly suited for our needs and where we wanted to be. And it's been quite a surprise. And yet the thing that the Lord has put in my heart for this year is that we need to step into becoming a house of prayer for all nations. And I see deep resonance with that burden on my heart to become a house of prayer for all nations and losing our house, our place of worship. Like that's in the thread of even that phrase where Jesus picked it up from the prophets. It's like, it's not this place. He is making a people who will become a house of prayer for all nations, and his spirit is building a new house, which will become a house of prayer for all nations. And so, man, if we could just step into the presence of God with a deeper hunger and fervency and spiritual thirst than we've ever had before as a church, even if we lose our space, even if we lose people because we lose our space, I think that may be where God is leading us in this pruning. House of prayer for all nations, but I would love to see that the way we see it right now is a house of prayer for all nations, one table at a time. And so in 3 to 5 years, I would love to see our groups swell and then start new groups with new leaders that the Lord will bring us, because we've been begging, Lord, would you bring us leaders? Would you bring us people with maturity too? Where like these young people and the Gen Z people and the children that we're talking about, including my own, I have to adjust my unicorn. That's my
I wasn't gonna say anything.
my daughter's unicorn headphones was all I could think
Those
of.
were the headphones you could
And I
find
was
it.
thinking of my kids though, and like in 5 years, my daughter's gonna be 16. My oldest daughter's gonna be 16.
Wow,
And
man, yeah.
I want her to be a part of a faith community where we're praying with her people in a home is as normal as just any other Tuesday. And where there are, if we have like a core now of college and young adults, in 5 years, what if the Lord made that fruitful? To where some of their spiritual hungers and desires that secularism will never satisfy, what if they could actually find expression in homes, through prayerful encounters with the living God in a community of people, as they're just kind of sharing life in community? And I think the more of those kind of pockets of houses of prayer that you get, then the more even kind of places of worship that you could get around the city. So that's what the Lord has put on my heart for the next 3 to 5 years. And yet it's interesting how he may even be stripping away some of my perception of the house that I thought was going to be part of that. And it's leaning more into our early roots, where no, it's not that house. It's all of our houses need to become houses of prayer, one table at a time. So, man, you asked me a question about like vision and future, and I start preaching. So,
Old
I
habits
can't,
die hard, my friend.
I know. Can't stop, won't stop. There you
Yeah.
go.
Smith
Never
has
had a
been
dime, always had a vision. See?
Smith,
Yeah.
it's been a delight to catch up with you and to hear a little bit more about Oikos. It's I don't know if sad is the right way to put it, to know that there's some changes coming up that are potentially, worrisome. But I found that in my own experience here, and you know everything that I'm gonna tell you, but can't stop, won't stop. I found that in my experience when the certainty is no longer to be found, that's when I am faced with the choice of try and do it myself or lean on the Lord, throw myself into prayer, and then to act faithfully with what I know I have to do at the time. There was a situation recently where my wife and the boys both had the stomach bug, and like they were kind of dropping like flies. And this was a couple of months ago. And I had work I needed to do, like I needed to get some stuff done, and because it was time sensitive. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking about it. It's like, man, like this is all troubling. And then I'm hesitant to say that it was the voice of God, but sometimes you'll hear something that just rings with such divine clarity that it might be foolish to think it's anything but God. But I heard, the statement came into my mind. Do you trust me? It's like, yes, I do. I do. Yes, sir, I do. And then the next thing said, okay, then just get to work. And as seemingly insignificant as that was, because like, man, I didn't have time to get sick. I didn't end up actually getting sick. I did not get sick, and was able to finish the things that I needed to finish in time. But that conversation, if you could call it that, just has stuck with me for so long. It's like, all right, you know what you need to do, then get to it. And I don't want to say, and God will take care of the rest, as if it's somewhat cliche, but you and I both have seen that happen in our ministries. And
That's right.
so if there's any encouragement for me to offer you, it's to know that God surely did not bring you all this far to just leave you there. So, Smith, how can we find out more about Oikos and what y'all are up to?
We have a website, oikosmemphis.org, OIKOS,
Okay.
memphis.org.
I'll link to that in the description below.
Honestly, if you want to send me an email, that's fine too. I'm not on social media, so that's not a good place to find me. Smith@oikosmemphis.org. So, if you're a young person or a mature leader and you are moving to Memphis, come look us up, visit us on a Sunday, and I'd love to connect with you. And Kevin, what you were just saying really resonates. Man, we went through a season of prayer and fasting as a church during the Lenten season, and we were praying for more hunger for God, and that seemed like a really innocent prayer. And until there was a desperation for God to move and to work and to open doors and to help. So he very much answered that prayer to hunger for our community to be able to hunger for God in a special way. And there's nothing like when he takes away the things that you didn't even know you were relying on for security, to reveal that, he is still, my rock and my refuge and my light and my salvation. So, it's been a great grace that moved through sadness and loss into just a great hopeful expectation of what he's going to do next. And I'm here for it. Whatever that is, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So, I will seek to be a faithful servant in whatever it is that he calls me and my family and our little church to.
And that's all we can do. And that's not intended to be a truism or cliche or anything like that. That really is the Smith. I think I might have mentioned this when we saw each other at the HST re reunion. I know that I've talked to somebody else about this, which, by the way, that reminds me something I was going to tell you earlier. One of the things that I have always been impressed with by you is your ability to listen and ask good questions. Because we sat down at breakfast or lunch one day there in Memphis a couple of months ago, and you just asked me a couple of insightful questions about the podcast. It's like, oh, yeah, that's really appreciate that. And I always feel like you are listening well. So that be encouraged with that.
Yeah, that's
But
really interesting.
when I was talking with you or somebody else, the I was telling them that in ministry, I found that the thing that I keep coming back to is the parable of the talents, that whether you're given five or two or one, the master is not at all upset with the two talent person because he didn't generate five more. And so maybe a faithful adaptation of that parable would be, in some seasons we have five talents to work with, and in other seasons we're given one talent to work with. And so maybe Oikos is in a one talent season now, and instead of burying it in the sand, y'all are told to go in and make one more. Anyway.
I'm certainly not going to bury it in the sand. I may have to show my hands to the Lord and say, "Sorry, Lord, I lost several of them, but I didn't bury it."
I didn't bury it in the sand. Yeah. Smith, it was a
Thank you,
pleasure to
Kevin.
catch up with you, sir.
Yeah, it's been a blessing. Thank you, Kevin.
Right. Bye-bye.